This is First Draft on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts. My guest is Amina Gauthier, author of two short story collections, At Risk and Now We Will Be Happy. She has published more than 85 short stories. She has a master's degree and PhD in English literature and teaches in the MFA program at the University of Miami. She is a native New Yorker. We began the interview talking about her collection, Now We Will Be Happy, and how she came up with the title.
Now We Will Be Happy is the name of a famous song by Rafael Hernandez, who is a famous Puerto Rican composer, and he's celebrated throughout all of Puerto Rico, much revered, well-respected, fabulous musician and composer. And the title, the song is in Spanish, so the title is Ahora Seremos Felices, but the English equivalent of that is Now We Will Be Happy. So, you know, that song directly appears in the story. It's kind of like diegetic. So they hear the song, he explains it to her, and they dance with each other. But to me, it was what all the stories in the collection were about, that, you know, different people, I mean, it sounds reductive to say different people need different things to make them happy, you know, but some characters need something just, you know, so something small or something, you know, metaphoric, something symbolic. And they each need to know what the other person's version of happiness is in order to deal with them or interact with them, and not try to offer someone else your version of happiness and then, you know, be upset or frustrated if that's not what the other person wants. And you know, all the stories are about the different things, the different lengths that the characters are willing to go to try to find and achieve their methods of happiness. And I love that title because there's no punctuation in it, so the reader can decide where to put the inflection, you know, so it can be read as Now We Will Be Happy, you know, or it can be read as Now We Will Be Happy, you know, or it can be Now We Will Be Happy, right? Or Now We Will Be Happy, you know, and all four of those inflections, I think, you know, are appropriate for the reading of the collection.
When I read, I keep a list in the front of the book of things that come up in some of the stories or repeating objects or themes. So here's a list of some of the things that I noticed. The role of grandparents, Barbie dolls, abandonment, men too weak to face their realities, food and cooking, and the ideas of Puerto Ricans versus immigrants. Probably some of that has to do with a lack of knowledge, maybe on the mainland, of where Puerto Ricans actually fit into our culture. And they're not immigrants to our culture, but they have a distinct culture, but maybe on the job, they don't get preference over immigrants who might get paid less. So those were some of the things that I noticed. Do you want to comment on any of those, or do you want me to ask you more specific questions?
When I was writing those stories, I wasn't actually putting that in there to prove a point. I thought that this was common knowledge. And, you know, I think this comes from my background in New York, you know, which is a city that, you know, has a substantial number of Puerto Ricans. So just growing up my whole life, that seems to be something that everyone in New York has always known. You know, there are New Yorkers, you know, Puerto Ricans who are just born in New York who don't even speak Spanish or who never go back. There are Puerto Ricans who go back, like my aunts and uncles will go back during the cold months and then come back here when it's warmer. But it's just pretty much understood in New York that Puerto Ricans are not immigrants and that they are deeply woven into New York culture, you know, specifically when you think of hip hop and breakdancing, that, you know, hip hop is started and cultivated by African Americans and Puerto Ricans simultaneously. So this isn't something that I thought I ever had to think about or explain until I moved away from the East Coast and went further inland and, you know, living in St. Louis, living in Milwaukee, living in Chicago, I realized that was not a narrative that was ubiquitous. And so I started to realize that there is a kind of betweenness that Puerto Rican identity occupies, in which it's assumed that because they are Latino and because they come from an island, that they are immigrants. And a lot of people, I guess, are just unaware of the Jones Act of 1917 that has made Puerto Ricans U.S. citizens, or maybe they haven't been to Puerto Rico, so they don't notice that when they fly into the airport, one of the first things you see is a big sign that says, "Welcome to the United States," and you don't need a passport or anything like that. So as a writer, that complexity, I think, just has offered a lot of metaphorical space, you know, to think about double consciousness in a different way. Like in the first book, you know, I talked about code switching or double consciousness with, you know, Black youth who, you know, were maybe attending an Upper East Side elite schools, but who maybe lived in sort of economically blighted neighborhoods. And so they had to learn two different cultural mechanisms to, you know, exist in their Brooklyn neighborhoods, but then to go and be successful in their private schools. And they had to sort of employ the kind of double consciousness that W.E.B. Du Bois mentions being sort of specific to African Americans. But then the sort of metaphorical space that Puerto Ricans occupy in our culture, I think, introduces a different kind of double consciousness that's actually more externalized, in which they're being read in two different ways by people who view them, and then they have to react and respond to that. So, you know, it can create a kind of defensiveness where you have to kind of keep saying, "I'm not an immigrant. I belong here. I have every right to be here." And, you know, what that does to someone's psyche or their thought processes, how that affects someone's emotional responses when, you know, they go through their day and they feel they have to constantly defend their presence. You know, that you can get a lot of plot ideas for stories just from thinking of that one moment of complexity.
You're listening to First Draft on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest is Amina Gauthier, author of the short story collection Now We Will Be Happy. The food and the cooking, you know, is a very sensual part of your stories. Food is a big part of family life, but it also stands in for other sort of deeper lessons about life. So do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
I'm very interested in the political nature or the historical nature of food. And as a fiction writer, to be able to kind of capture the moment of someone cooking or preparing or following a recipe, I think is just sort of metaphorically symbolic, because you can capture all the details, but you're representing that person as an artist. So it's almost like you're talking about writing or talking about the creation of a story when you're talking about the creation of a meal. But with these particular stories and thinking of the mixture that makes Puerto Rican food, like its background, being pulled from African slaves, being pulled from Spaniards, and then also being pulled from the aboriginal natives, the Taino Indians, to make this sort of criollo food. Like, to me, that's very interesting because of its political background. You know, I haven't worked it all out, but it's something that I'm just greatly interested in. And so I keep playing with it in the collection. And so some characters, you know, are just preparing food as a way to sort of ritualize their culture and touch into it. And then there are some characters in the collection where food is actually harmful to them. You know, Rose's father, because of his dialysis, you know, has certain things that he's allowed to eat, and he is sort of cut off from the cultural richness of the food he grew up with because he's limited to eating only a certain number of things so that he doesn't exacerbate his illness.
I want to talk about one of your short stories. It's called Muñeca. That's a type of doll, correct?
Yes. It means doll or doll baby.
And so this story really focuses on two characters, Rosa and Pedro. And basically, this story is told from a close point of view to Pedro. And he has recently, maybe a year and a half, married Rosa, and they don't have enough money. So they live with Rosa's parents, and he feels like they don't like him. They don't give him much room, and he feels like less of a man by living there. The situation of them living there kind of blows up in the story. Do you want to talk a little bit about where this story originated for you and what it means to you?
Well, the story actually originated from a doll. So there are two dolls in the story. There is the wedding doll on his mother's or his parents' bureau, and then there's the black gift shop doll. And I had grown up seeing those dolls, the gift shop dolls, you know, the doll with the sort of plastic face and the eyes that blink backwards and the big straw skirt. I had seen them as a child in almost everyone's apartment in New York, I guess because people had been taking trips to the Bahamas, or if anyone took a trip to the Caribbean, like that seemed to be like the thing that they brought back with them. And some of them were like real dolls, and then some of them were kind of like air freshener covers or like toilet paper covers, and they would be like in the bathrooms on the top of toilet tapes. And when I first saw them as a kid, I just thought they were like regular dolls, and I wanted to play with them, and people would explain, like, you know, I'd, you know, be visiting with my relatives and we'd go over to someone's house and they would have this doll, and while the adults would be doing whatever they were doing, I would want something to do with, so I would want to play with the doll, and they would sort of say, well, no, that's a souvenir, and sort of explain that, like, it wasn't like a doll for playing with, like, it wasn't a toy, that it was, you know, this other thing. And then I took a trip, went to Barbados, went to the Caribbean myself in 2007, and I saw all these dolls, so I just bought one, and I brought her back. And I just had her, and from the process of just kind of having her on my desk and looking at her over a couple of months, that idea of the story was sort of born from there. Because those dolls, if you stand them up straight and their eyes aren't blinking, they just look like they're staring at you. But you know, having this doll made me think of the Twilight Zone episode with the talking Tina doll. There's a girl who's being abused by her stepfather, and she projects her feelings into this doll called Talking Tina, and the doll ends up being malicious, but in order to protect the girl, and the doll causes all kinds of havoc. So I guess the story came from those things. And you think of Pedro in all the stories as someone who's kind of super macho and who seems like overly confident and who is, you know, definitely abusive. And to think that part of his pathos could be attached to something that we would think of as so sort of small and innocuous is something that I sort of found compelling.
There's a scene where he basically comes home. The timeline of the story is very quick. It's all kind of one evening, and he comes home and is already filled with this angst because he's going to his mother-in-law's. And he goes, when he finally goes into the room that was Rose's childhood room that they now share, the parents had gotten her a new armoire, and then he noticed this muñeca doll next to it, and it brought back all these memories because he had three sisters that when he was a kid really tried to dress him up as this doll. So that seemed like to unleash something in him that maybe hadn't been unleashed. I got the feeling this was probably the first time he hit her. But
yes.
And so it is this complex trigger for him, because just because of what dolls stand for, but then what it means in his past, and she has no idea.
Exactly. And I didn't want to make him, you know, be like, I don't want to say that he has PTSD or anything, but that, you know, they have these different associations with the same sort of household and domestic items. And part of having that be the origin story between them is, like you said, Rosa has sort of no idea what the context is, you know, in which he experiences this doll. But you know, tragically, these are two people who get married who also have actually no idea of each other before they, you know, decide to live permanently with one another. You know, his rationale for choosing her is never really about who she is as an individual, you know, and Rosa feels as if she's been sort of cut off from her culture by her parents. And when she chooses Pedro, she's also projecting upon him, like thinking that he can sort of be this funnel back to her culture. So you have two people who have no idea of who the other one really is. And I think that gives the reader a kind of clear understanding of why their marriage would be doomed from the start. That there's so much subtext between the two of them that neither of them is aware of.
You're listening to First Draft on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest is Amina Gauthier, author of the short story collection, Now We Will Be Happy. So tell me about a writer that has influenced you. Can you read a passage from someone who's been an influence in your life as a writer?
Well, I am a big, devoted fan of Stuart Dybeck, and I have been a fan of him and his collection, The Coast of Chicago, since 1996. And it just, like, tore the top of my head off. I was just blown away. I thought it was just the best, most amazing story ever. To this day, Pet Milk remains one of my favorite stories. Dybeck remains one of my favorite authors. And I love the whole story, but I would like to read the last two paragraphs of it. We were speeding past scorched brick walls, gray windows, back porches outlined in sun, roofs and treetops, the landscape of the L I'd memorized from subway windows over a lifetime of rides, the podiatrist's foot sign past Fullerton, the bright pennants of Wrigley Field and Addison, ancient hotels with transients' welcome signs on their flaking black back walls, peeling and graffiti-smudged billboards, the old cemetery just before Wilson Avenue. Even without looking, I knew almost exactly where we were. Within the compartment, the sound of our quick breathing was louder than the clatter of tracks. I was trying to slow down, to make it all last, and when she covered my mouth with her hand, I turned my face to the window and looked out. The train was braking a little from express speed, as it did each time it passed the local station. I could see blurred faces on the long wooden platform watching us pass, businessmen glancing up from folded newspapers, women clutching purses and shopping bags. I could see the expression on each face momentarily arrested as we flashed by. A high school kid in shirt sleeves, maybe 16, with books tucked under one arm and a cigarette in his mouth, caught sight of us. And in the instant before he disappeared, he grinned and started to wave. Then he was gone, and I turned from the window, back to Kate, forgetting everything, the passing stations, the glowing late sky, even the sense of missing her. But that arrested wave stayed with me. It was as if I were standing on that platform with my school books in a smoke on one of those endlessly accumulated afternoons after school when I stood almost outside of time, simply waiting for a train, and I thought how much I'd have loved seeing someone like us streaming by.
Do you want to say anything else about that?
Well, I would just maybe talk a bit about my initial ignorance. So I said the story collection is called The Coast of Chicago, which would tell an intelligent person that the stories are probably set in Chicago. But when I read Pet Milk, to me, it seemed as if it were set in New York because of all the references to the L and the train and the subway and the platform and the tracks. And that's part of what drew me in to think of a person who's sort of writing about cities and the kind of basic architecture of them, like what it's like to just to be on a train that's going express. And, you know, that's something that, you know, by the time I'd read that story that I had done for, you know, 20 years of my life without ever, you know, having thought about or paid attention to. And it was one of the first lessons for me, just, you know, not like a lesson that was taught in a workshop, but reading that story, you know, just sort of brought it home for me that you can find, you know, a short story anywhere, just in your basic day-to-day commute, you know, just what you do, like just what I did to wake up in the morning and get to school in the morning and take the train to Manhattan, that that was a short story. That was just, you know, I felt as if I had, like, you know, discovered fire or gold or something. You know, as a, you know, 19, 20 year old wanting to write, you know, you feel like you don't have stories, or that, you know, you have to, like, go out and have some sort of major experience to write a story. You think short stories have to be about, like, car crashes or wars or utopias, you know, because you've been reading things like 1984 and Brave New World and, you know, things like that. So you're thinking, like, where am I going to get a story from? I'm only, like, 19 or 20. And to think that there are stories every day, you know, just from you going back and forth throughout your life, but that you're not noticing them and that you're not paying attention to them, and that if you would just kind of look more closely and observe that you're surrounded by short stories. I mean, I just thought that was the best thing ever. And, you know, and this story definitely gave that to me.
Can you read something that you wrote that was maybe hard or tricky to write, or something that changed a lot from the first draft?
I would read last page and a half of the first story in the collection, which is called Aguanile. The story actually ends in a flashback, so I'll read that. On my last night in Puerto Rico, my grandfather called me into the living room. He said to me, "This is what you didn't hear." He put on a record and positioned the two speakers on the floor so that they turned more fully toward us. He would have sung this if they hadn't stopped him, but they didn't give him the chance. My grandfather's joy at attending the performance had been cut short when the concert ended abruptly. One minute, we could hear Hector singing, and the next, the power on the stage had been shut off. The song was slow to start. It began as if it were in a jungle or a forest, with the sounds of birds cawing, chirping, tittering, and screeching. Elephants trumpeted. In the distance, drums spoke and voices chanted, putting me in the mind of what I guessed African music sounded like. The song went on like this, growing without words. Then the horns kicked in, followed by a man's voice singing one lone word, stretching it to its limit, repeating it and pulling everything and more from the word he sang over and over. Without warning, drums rolled and all the instruments seemed to come in at once. I'd never heard any kind of song like it. Beneath the familiar instruments, I heard the song of one I didn't know, a clanging like that of the small noisemakers sold on New Year's Eve. My grandfather identified it as the clave, the key, the rhythm, the heartbeat of all salsa. The drums drove the beating of my heart. Seated on the floor in front of the couch, I felt that I was moving.
So tell me why you chose this.
It was very difficult for me to write about music. And it's one of those things where sometimes you do something so much, or you're just so caught up in something, that it's hard to separate yourself and distance yourself and then detail it, you know. So I really love that song, Aguanile, but I couldn't tell somebody why I loved it, or, you know, understand what the pieces of, you know, what the pieces were in the song, or the way those pieces came together and were constructed to make me enjoy the song as much as I did. So I had to, you know, keep listening to it and try to not listen as a listener or as a lover of music enjoying the song, and try to listen as a writer and a critic and sort of understand what this song is doing, and try to sort of capture that without just saying, "I like the song, it's beautiful, like, isn't this music great?"
So where do you write?
Everywhere. And I mean that facetiously and seriously. Like, if I'm on a laptop, all I need is a flat surface. So any desk or any of those little fake folding desks that they have on airplanes and train stations. But I also write by hand. So, you know, I will take a spiral notebook. And when I go to craft talks or lectures or book signings and readings, a lot of times I would be listening to the writer, but I would be writing whatever is inspiring me. So I won't necessarily be writing about what I'm hearing, but just the act of being like surrounded by a lecture is sort of intellectually inspiring to me. So a lot of times I can get new material just from sort of being in the room.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I've never wanted to get away from writing yet. If anything, I'm always trying to get closer to it.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
Well, this is going to sound pretty arrogant, but I show it to myself. And by that, I mean that when I think I've finished something, I put it away. You know, I kind of hide it from myself for like at least 3 to 6 months. And then the next person to see it is me. And I'm trying to figure out when I read it, if when I read it, I can feel as if it was written by someone else. And only then would I show it to anyone. But what I do now, like if I've done that, like I've written it, I've let it lie fallow for 3 to 6 months, and then I've showed it to myself again, then the next pairs of eyes that would probably see it would be contests. You know, I would normally send it out for an initial round of contests to see if it comes back with any feedback. You know, so if it, you know, gets honorable mention or finalist or something like that, like I take that as a sign that I'm moving in the right direction, and then I just need to look at it again and rework it.
How have you dealt with rejection?
I'm actually pretty okay with it. Like, I have a really healthy relationship with rejection. I know that sounds strange, but might even sound stranger to say I like rejection. Not saying I want to be rejected all the time, but when I was an undergrad at Stanford, my instructor for intermediate fiction was Samantha Chang, who was the director of the program at Iowa. And before I ever started sending anything out, you know, she gave me this advice that told me to learn how to turn rejection into a game. So she said, you know, well, you send a story out, you're probably going to have to send it out, you know, however, 20, 30, 40, 50 times to different journals before someone picks it up. So instead of thinking about each rejection, you know, that comes in, you know, as something negative, you know, think about it as, wow, that's 50 or 60 people that have read my work, you know. So she said, like, make a game out of it. And that's what I've always done. So when I get rejections in, it's never actually sort of fazed me. Like, if I sent the story to 6 places and 3 come back with rejection, I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's 3 people that have read my work. And then I send it out to like to 3 new people. And so it's never been like something that's kind of like paralyzed me.
And what is your favorite word?
Writer.
You've been listening to First Draft on Aspen Public Radio. My guest was Amina Gauthier. You can hear the show again online at aspenpublicradio.org and also hear extra features from the interviews and learn more about the authors. You can follow First Draft on Facebook. Just look for First Draft on Aspen Public Radio and click like, and on Twitter at First Draft APR. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. Thanks for listening.